Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Dan McNeil, Danny Parkins. Afternoons on the Score.
You know this show loves malaprops. We have to address yours from yesterday.
Where is that at again, Hub? With all this stuff going on, I can't keep all my onions in a row here.
What is happening there?
I don't know what happened there, folks. I don't know exactly what that was, but we'll find out.
Ah, God.
I've heard ducks in a row. How do you get the onion?
I always watch one more tape after it's happened to make sure that I had all the ducks aligned. And
what I was trying to say was I should know my onions on this.
Onions!
And instead of knowing my onions, I collected them and I put them in a row for Hub's enjoyment. I can't keep all my onions in a row here. And I knew I was gone. You know, because I'm done.
In a row.
In a row?
Rick Dalton stammering. Eight whiskey sours. Gotta have eight.
You're sitting there like a baboon.
I put my onions in a row instead of knowing them. All I wanted to do is express, I feel like it's my responsibility to know my onions. Instead of, you know, expressing that, I put them in a row.
You gotta know your onion.
I can't keep all my onions in a row here. Stutter and stammer and bitch.
Spit it out, you sputtering bitch.
Onions, 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 onions,
onions. In a row here.
Yo! Saddle up! Lock and load!
The McNeil and Parkin Show. Afternoons 2 to 6 on 670 The Score and 670thescore.com. Chicago's sports station.
We might not know what we're talking about, but our next guest has his ducks in a row. He knows his onions. He covers baseball for The Athletic. Evan Drellick joins us on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline. Alpamonte Ford is in Melrose Park. He and Ken Rosenthal have been all over this story on the players' union and their negotiation with the owners in the midst of a pandemic with the CBA set to expire after next baseball season. It's a complicated story, and Evan has been doing great work on it. Evans, thank you so much for the time. How are you doing today?
Doing good. Thanks, guys.
So where are we now? What's the latest?
We're waiting to see how the union responds to the league's proposal. The belief is a counterproposal is coming. I guess there's still a chance they could give no counterproposal at all, but as we reported last night, what they intend to ask for is an increase in the number of games. The league wants to play roughly 82 games. The way the money works right now, the players make more money on a per-game basis. So the players will ask for a number of games greater than 82. And the other thing we reported is they're not keen on giving back money. Surprise, surprise. They don't want to take any pay cuts. So that fight's still going.
You know, we heard locally today, Evan, and good to have you on board, from Ian Happ of the Cubs, who expressed some optimism about the way this has gone on a percentage basis. Where would you suspect the players are at right now in terms of how many of them are vehemently pissed off about what they saw in the first proposal versus those who would say, hey, we're starting?
You know, a percentage is hard. I will say that the basically unanimous reaction that we got on Tuesday when they made that proposal was negative. Whereas going into Tuesday, before the league made that offer, there were plenty of people, involved on the player side, I'm talking about agents who were on the fence or even critical of the union's approach so far. But I think the majority looked at the proposal the league made and said, that's not going to work. What are they trying to do here? And had a suspicious look at it. So the players 2 days after the proposal seemed to be much more galvanized than they were before. That's not to say that they were fractured before, but you've seen the outpouring of sentiment this week, and that's directly in response to that proposal.
We expected it to get ugly. Millionaires and billionaires fighting publicly in the midst of a pandemic, it's not normally going to be received well by the public. Has it been uglier than you expected?
Probably. That's probably true. We saw the money fight coming. I don't think we saw the money fight playing out quite like this. Maybe that was naive. But a point I keep making, and it's true, these guys have been at each other's throats for a while, publicly. It's not new for Tony Clark and Rob Manfred to be going back and forth through the media, through quotes. They were doing it over issues of service time, tanking, how the smaller market teams spend their money. But the difference is now the restart of the sport hangs in the balance and everybody's paying attention. I think you have to be a particular type of baseball fan or simply just a really hardcore baseball fan to be following every bit of that commissioner level banter that exists normally. But this isn't some sort of new development where all of a sudden they hate each other. It's been like this for a while.
Is there any way, Evan, you can put a timetable on when some progress will be made or even when a deal will be struck?
June 1st is the date that we keep reporting and others keep reporting as well as a soft deadline. I asked somebody today, multiple people today, how firm or not firm is that? The reality is they can go beyond June 1st. All that you're doing is you're potentially pushing the season back and or shortening the season, and that's going to impact the money one way or another. A, you can't have a season go into January. You know, you have to have guys rest up for 2021. But if the players now want as many games as possible, well, the longer you wait, the harder that becomes. So the first week of June, next week was looking like something of a deadline. Does it mean it's dead if we're at next Friday and they don't have a deal? No, but there's only so long you can go with this.
Evan Drellick is our guest. He covers Major League Baseball for The Athletic. He has been at the forefront of the reporting on the labor negotiations between the players' union and the owners for Major League Baseball. Evan, I don't ask this question lightly, but just reading some tea leaves here, maybe call it tinfoil hat conspiracy theory, that's fine. Are we sure that the owners want a season?
It's a good question. There's suspicion of that, and probably would always be suspicion of that on the player's side, that maybe some owners don't want to play. There is division amongst the owners in so much as some are better incentivized to play than others. The big market teams are in an odd way hurting more here. Even if you have this great TV deal, if you can't have fans in your ballpark, if you're the Yankees, Red Sox, Dodgers, go down the list, Cubs, White Sox, it hurts you more because you were relying on the gate more than you normally would. So at the end of the day, the incentives are there to play. That's one of the guiding lights here for optimism that we're going to get baseball, because the sport long-term is better off. Both sides, owners and players, are better off if they play. So yeah, there could be some owners who look at their own individual financial situation and think it might not be ideal for them. But, you know, overall, everybody gets it. They need to play if they want to make the most money possible over the long term.
Are all 30 teams financially solvent enough to withstand a year without baseball? I mean, would you suspect anybody would go under if there weren't a season?
Go under, I don't think so, no. The state of MLB owner finances is very complicated. There was a letter that Scott Boras sent around yesterday talking about the debt service rule and the amount of debt that owners accumulate and the accounting practices, it's complicated. Some owners don't put as much money into their team as others. Some of them take out massive loans to build ancillary things, ballpark villages, things like that, so they can be highly leveraged. At the end of the day, the franchise values still keep climbing and have always climbed. In this climate, it's probably a little harder to sell if everybody's worried about a recession and a downturn and how long that goes. But to this point, there's no indication that you're going to see a Major League Baseball team fold, no.
How worried are the owners that a second wave of the virus would wipe out the playoffs and therefore wipe out the lucrative TV money they're expecting?
That's definitely a part of it. The playoffs do bring the biggest dollars. The MLB estimate is about $780 million for the postseason money this year, whereas the regular season national TV money is 555 or so. So it's big money, and they are concerned that if they play a longer regular season, they're jeopardizing that. And you could take a cynical view that some people on the player's side have, that the owners in reality want as many regular season games as possible, that they're actually just holding up that coronavirus fear as kind of a negotiating ploy where they too want the games. They just want to use it in the negotiating to make the players think they're getting something when in reality it's something both sides might want. So it depends who you ask, but yes, that sentiment is out there.
When I read and now hear, because he said it on CNBC and on a call with the season ticket holders, that Tom Ricketts, the owner of the Cubs, claims that 70% of the Cubs' revenue comes from game day, not just gate, but game day. So there could be fuzzy accounting with, you know, the things that they own around the ballpark, and they are about to start a new TV deal and all of that. But 70% strikes me and many around here as very high. How do you react to that number?
That number might be a reference to the local money, period. I don't know if that includes accounting for the national revenue streams. Overall, by category in 2019, this is the information Major League Baseball gave to the Players Association going back 2 weeks. 39%, roughly 40% of revenue comes from the gate and other in-park things. 40% is the working number. What exactly is being referenced in that 70% is something that would have to be clarified, and that's one of the tricky things in any discussion and in the act of reporting for me personally on all this. When someone says a loss, what does it mean? It's difficult to sort out, and you have to dig into the numbers, essentially.
Right, because when they say they're going to lose $4 billion as it stands now, you don't know if that is, like, actual losses or losses of what they were previously expecting to generate, correct?
We do know now what they mean by that, and whether you believe it is a whole other question. But what they mean is that inside of 2020, not based on any projection, simply cash flow in an 82-game season without fans, they are saying they would lose $4 billion, that they would make $4 billion less than they would spend. That is what they mean by it, but you're exactly getting at what I'm getting at.
Okay, so we don't exactly know. They just that Ricketts number is throwing me for quite a loop, and it doesn't compute, right? There's something else there that we don't know. When Tom Ricketts says 70%, you would say that's fair for us to say.
When he refers to our revenues, is he talking about what is produced by the Cubs, excluding the national media streams? Is he simply referring to local revenue, or is he accounting for everything? And I don't know the answer to that. And if you made that clear in the CNBC interview, I apologize, I don't know it. But it requires more information.
And so locally here in Chicago, you would imagine, given the Cubs with their own new TV network, their attendance and all that, the Cubs are the team that is less incentivized to play right now than the White Sox. Is that also, is that fair to say?
Yeah, the highest earning teams at the gate are going to be in that group. So the Cubs would be ahead of the White Sox in that. Where it gets complicated is based on the TV deal. If you have a better TV deal, it's a little easier. And I don't know whether the Cubs or the White Sox have a richer deal. I assume it would be the Cubs. But it's not the standard big market, small market division that you would see. A team like the Rays, oddly enough, would probably have an easier time playing from a financial perspective this year than the Yankees, at least from one perspective.
Once there is baseball, and I don't know if this is something many have given much thought to, it's all about the labor negotiations right now, but once there's baseball, Evan, is there a team that stands to benefit because of a truncated season for whatever reason? Players coming back from surgeries. We have a few guys on the White Sox who weren't going to be a part of their roster early on. Anybody going to hold a little bit of an advantage we didn't typically think of when we think of 162 games?
You know, I, to be honest, I haven't gone through every roster. What jumps out at me, and I thought about this a little bit, it's probably the team that in a longer season is on the fringe. It's the team that's good, and if they get hot, you know, can rattle off whatever, 15-4 run. You do that out of the gate in an 82-game season, even if you're in 162 games, probably not going to be there at the end. You know, think about how different standings look in a half season, and that's what you're talking about playing. July looks a lot different than September or October. So, you know, a team like the White Sox might be better positioned than they would be normally.
We're talking to Evan Drellick for just another couple of minutes here from The Athletic. Do you think this is going to get done? Like, prediction business time. Do you think we will have a baseball season?
Yeah, I remain hopeful, optimistic, and possibly naive on this. We're just not at the break point yet where you have to feel like the doomsday scenario is unfolding. You can take a reasonable position that everything that's going on is leverage creation and negotiating tactics. And once push comes to shove, once a deadline arrives in their face, and at some point, one way or another, it feels like it has to, then that's the moment. But we're just not there yet. They have a little bit of time to play with bandying these proposals back and forth. And again, the incentives are there. There's too much on the line. You have a CBA up after next year. The trickle-down effects and the ripple effects of not playing would be massive, and I think everybody knows that, and therefore everybody would have a reason to find some sort of common ground.
Have you heard anyone speculate on how they would quantify the damage to baseball? We know what happened after 94, right? It took cheating and Cal Ripken Jr. and the home run chase for it to come back. Have you heard anyone from the owners or players side speculate on what quantitative damage it would do if they didn't have a season?
I haven't gotten a specific number of billions, but you know it's going to be in the billions if that were to happen. And I get the fascination with what would happen there. I would just wait a week for it or even 2 weeks. It's just not at that point where the 94 comparison is exactly due, you know, and in a worst case scenario, there's a process they could go through with an arbitrator. There could be a grievance. There could be a hearing. It could be very dramatic, but an arbitrator could rule in favor of one side or the other and basically force the sport to start back up. So even if they can't come to an agreement, that doesn't necessarily mean everything would be dead yet, but we're playing out pretty deep hypotheticals.
Which is what sports radio was invented for.
Absolutely.
Last thing, does anyone really have an expectation that baseball players will not be spitting upon the return of the game?
Yeah, everybody was very concerned about those health protocols before the money kicked back up. Yeah, I don't see any way they can observe everything that's going to be in there, but at the end of the day, the health protocols are there for everybody's benefit. You know, they're going to get through those and amending those, I believe, without too much of a hitch. There could be little fights over it, but once they get the money piece in line, they'll figure out what the right rules are. Not everybody's going to be perfect to a T, but as long as they've got the big things covered, you know, if a guy in the bullpen shows somebody his grip for a slider and it's a ball that some other pitcher was assigned to be throwing because you're not supposed to be moving balls back and forth, you know, what are you going to do? It's not going to be perfect.
Yes, by relative comparison to figuring out how to split up all of these billions of dollars, that feels like a minor issue to negotiate. Evan, you have been doing great work on this reporting. We've been reading everything that you've been writing. Appreciate the time, man.
Thanks, Evan.
Thanks, guys.
Take care.
It's Evan Drellick from The Athletic. I know what he's saying in a macro sense, that like people are asking the question that I asked at the top of the show. Are we positive the owners want this based on these deals? He says maybe some of them in the short term would say that it's not in their best interest to play, but all of their franchise valuations would be hurt if there's no season. So you'd have to think that some of them are at least capable of thinking in the big picture, right? Because just the sport overall would be so damaged. You remember the 94 season, you know, better than I do in terms of the anger of fans, but I don't really know how to quantify it other than baseball already has a problem attracting young fans. There's so many more entertainment options now. All these sports are going to be coming back at the same time. If baseball isn't there, it will just feel like a huge missed opportunity for the game.
It will, Danny, but I wonder if it's going to be opposite everything else that expects to be part what typically is baseball's month, October. And it does have to compete with college and pro football, but baseball is October time. It's if you throw all of the other sports that you don't usually see that go later into the calendar, we've talked about the Derby being run in September and other events that are pushed way back. If hockey and basketball are playing postseason series in September, as you know, some are speculating they will. What's that? Does baseball get lost in the shuffle anyway? I don't know. I'm just asking. And you're right. I mean, there are a million options for young people and old people, but young people who take advantage of them, and ways to get entertainment that don't include guys trying to collect 54 outs over 3.5 hours.
Yeah, you're right that, you know, Masters in November, when the World Series would be just wrapping up with NFL and college in full swing and everything else. Sure. But better to be lost in the shuffle of all of the other sports but still cater to your diehards than to have the only headline of your sport to be, we couldn't figure out the billions in the midst of the pandemic.
Yeah, and the money's in the playoffs. That's when the TV money comes into play. And I would have to think it's something they absolutely would prefer to avoid, unless they're just so full of themselves and absolutely so solid monetarily that they could feel they can survive it. As if they're trying to prove a point, if they're going to think with what's between their legs instead of what's between their ears, that always is a possibility, because some of these owners have gigantic egos.
I would imagine most of them have gigantic egos. Yeah, it's uglier than I thought it was going to be, and I thought it was going to be ugly. I still assume a deadline will make a deal and they will not be that short-sighted, but I wouldn't be loving it if I'm a diehard baseball fan right now who, like, this is your game. Because it's not a sport that can afford a bunch of bad headlines. Frankly, neither can the NBA is super popular and growing in popularity and popular with young people. Not a sport that really wants to have a bunch of negative headlines right now. The NFL is the only one that really seems to be Teflon for that sort of thing. It's not what baseball wants to be doing in the midst of the splintered opinion business and audiences going different directions and trying to captivate young people. It's not long-term growth for the sport there. And that Tom Ricketts 70% number, it doesn't make sense. I think he's maybe saying, because we haven't made money yet from Marquee,
And you got to factor in, you know, Gallagher Way and the rooftops and the hotel and parking and tickets and concessions. And, you know, like, you add in all of these different things, then maybe you can get to it. But it just, all of the teams average to 40%, and he's saying it's 70%. That just, that feels grossly out of whack to me.
Yeah, it is. And every time I hear the mentions of things that benefit the teams on game day, I can't help but reflect to our favorite Boston movie, The Town, when the florist is telling the boys about their heist at Fenway Park, four games against New York, 60,000 beers.
Yeah.
All the souvenirs.
Taking down the Cathedral of Boston. Priceless.
Total haul, $4 million.
The cash is brought out and stacked 15 minutes before the van does the pickup. That is when you hit. A Monday morning, after a four-game stand with New York, 60,000 beers, food, merchandise, total haul, $3.5 million. Taking down the Cathedral of Boston. Priceless.
I liked it better when the florist did it.
Yeah. Guy whose eyes lit up the most when he heard the figure of $3.5 million, Gem. Oh, that appealed to him. That's all he needs. What am I going to do, go down to Margaritaville?
He gave up 9 years. He gave up nine years for this score. He needs it. He needs this.
The leaders want you to open this door. We have men outside your homes.
Belinda's.
We can just pot up the audio from Max the Town Room in Mac Manor for the rest of the show, and I would be very, very satisfied. It's McNeil and Parkins on the score.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify is got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odyssey podcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odyssey podcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/odyssey podcast.
People that are listening really need to know that about us as players, is that we really do want to get back and play, and we're doing all we can to get back and play, and that's our number one goal, along with obviously the health that comes with it. But we want to get back and play, and it's important for people to know that.
That's Whit Merrifield on 610 Sports Radio in Kansas City. Know a little something about that station. I believe that the players want to play. In all of these cases, the players have less staying power than the owners, less appetite for no revenue than the owners, because they're millionaires instead of being billionaires. So, yeah, I have no question that the players want to play. Do you agree, Mac, that they are taking a pay cut by agreeing to prorated salaries? Because as pro player as I am in these things, and I think that they
felt like they had an agreement, and they're the ones taking the risk. They're the ones who have to break social distancing and get in planes and travel in hotels and all of that, and the owners don't. So I am overwhelmingly with the players on this dispute with the owners, but they haven't taken a pay cut, right? Like, they're working less, so they're making less. It's not like they're saying, hey, you've got to take a 20% pay cut and a prorated salary. All they're doing is taking a prorated salary so far.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, is this a semantical debate? I think it winds up being one. By having the season, thus having their income, they've lost money, but have they taken a pay cut? No, they're just not earning as much money. So,
well, right, like we agreed to pay cuts, right? We're working the same, right? 4 hours a day, radio show and the prep, right, or whatever that goes into it, for a, right, salary, and then taking a pay cut.
Right.
They're still training, but they're not traveling, they're not playing games. So if they play 82 of 162 and they get paid their full amount for those 82, they didn't take a pay cut. And you could say it's semantics all you want. That's what this is. This is a negotiation. It's all semantics. It's lawyers from both sides getting in a room to try to hammer out a deal. So if I was advising the players from a PR standpoint, I wouldn't be arguing on behalf of we've already taken a pay cut.
Okay, I understand that position, because you know you're getting no sympathy from John Q. Public or Joe Cool in this matter. People just don't want to hear that, even people who are financially fine and, you know, are working. People just don't want to hear that from athletes, and I think that's unfortunate, because I don't believe these are guys who won lotteries to get where they are, but that's the way a high percentage of people in America, probably worldwide, look at pro jocks. I never have, and if you have the financial wherewithal to say to management here, the baseball union says, you know, no thanks. We are thumbing our nose at this. If they have that type of leverage, I don't begrudge them a second. And I would not begrudge anybody at our place of employment who would have felt similarly and refused to take a pay cut. And if so financially okay that they can afford to get whacked, you know, God bless them if you're in that position. That's a position most people would be like, you know, would love to be in, and maybe that's at the root of all the anger, too, is the envy that people have for pro athletes. And not all of them are millionaires. That's a misunderstanding also. They're not all millionaires.
That is correct. And, you know, Bernstein put up a poll question today, like, if you had to choose, who would you side with, players or owners in this? And over 80% said the players. And the results of that surprised me a little bit, but I do think, like, Bernstein has been very pro-player in this, and I think that there's probably a bit of a sampling issue there, right? Like, if Fox News runs a poll and MSNBC runs the exact same poll, you're going to get very different responses based on, like, what their audience is, right?
So, like, yes, you are.
Right? So the people who are following Bernstein or his show account, who maybe have more of his sensibilities, which on this issue are similar to, like, my sensibilities as being very pro-player, I think that's – it would be different if, say, ESPN ran it on their account with 10 million or something Twitter followers that would be more representative of common sports fans than those who listen to the Dan Bernstein show.
Yeah, you're probably right. And I think it would be wrong on our part to assume that a high percentage of the people who listen to the Dan Bernstein show also are wondering when their travels are ever going to get them back to good old gay Paris so they can enjoy the fresh waft of freshly baked bread coming out of all those fantastic patisseries that Dan is missing. And deep, deep, deep in his loins, he's missing those. Au bon pain, where are you right now? He is without them. So he will have to just grind it out until he has an opportunity to travel abroad again. And I hope it's soon for him, because that's something he loves. And I think he'll manage without it. He is managing, I believe, as everybody has, or as most people have, without whatever it is that is their passion, be it travel or going to live music venues. sporting events, whatever it is. I mean, we've all been put on hold, and dealing with it is what will define us in the end, and dealing with the virus is what's going to define us also.
Right, it's not what happens to you, it's how you react to what happens to you, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And that's
beautifully put.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, you keep saying, you know, there's chocolate and there's vanilla. Dan misses traveling to Paris for the fresh bread. You are, you know, worried about getting across the border to Canada in an RV. Yeah. So, you know.
I know. Actually, I'm not taking an RV to Canada. I'm taking an RV to Western United States. I'll be driving.
Oh, my apologies.
Right.
You're right.
Yeah.
My apologies.
My vacations are hard to keep organized in your head.
Yeah, that's true. It's like, okay.
You miss so many of them.
2 weeks to the West Coast in an RV and then 4 weeks to Canada in a truck. It's keeping tabs on where in the world is Carmen Macchiego is very, very difficult.
Don't know why I continue to refer to them as vacation.
They're vacations, even if you're not getting paid. They're vacations.
You could call them a vacation, or you could call them a furlough, I guess, right? Furlough. Yeah, furlough.
Travels.
Time. Yeah, travel time.
Yeah, right. You're traveling.
Right. Happy to have it.
That's good. I'm glad you're happy to have it. We have some finality for NFL proposed rule changes. We'll update you before Joe coming up on the Score.
We apologize to all of you at home.
Oh, that's a low point for me in terms of, wow, that was a mistake. I apologize profusely for that. Tanny just really got me, and we like the drops in the middle of the Team Hochberg reads.
Oh, and David loves him too. David's going to love that read. I mean,
yeah, oh, I'm sure he will. Yeah, people say that we got to give the money back on that one. No, that'll probably be one of his favorites, but I was just caught in absolute broadcast hell there because I called it the Mueller report when it was the Miller report, a very, very different issue. And then I found myself laughing at that. And then the next sentence of the read is about a nurse who had been exposed to COVID-19. And so I'm giggling at my own mistake about talking about something very serious. And then all hell broke loose and I wasn't able to recover. I apologize.
I enjoyed it. I thought it was really good. I thought, I'm just kicking back with my feet up, holding my microphone, waiting to come back. I'm thinking, I'm enjoying this guy suffering for a few seconds.
I'd get a kick out of it.
It's a crowd pleaser.
Yeah, that was really, really not good. And I'm sure Tanny will be a good friend and never make me relive any of that on the air.
Yeah, you can count on that. That tape's already been destroyed.
Yeah, that's not great. Texter says, how can Parkins be so ghastly uninformed on this topic? The owner's proposal is not simply a prorated salary. Mike Trout would be taking an 80% pay cut. I was saying that the players' union stance is that they have already agreed to a pay cut in the form of a prorated salary. That's directly from Max Scherzer, who's on the players' subcommittee. That's directly from his statement. And what I am saying is, if I was advising them from a PR standpoint, I would not make the argument that a prorated salary is a pay cut, because it's not. You're working less, and so you're getting paid your full amount for the games that you work. It's not like the owners said, this year we're playing 82 games in 162 because they want to. It's a pandemic that forced it. You could say that's a semantical argument. That's fine, but it's not technically a pay cut. What the owners are proposing, of course, is a massive pay cut, and that's why they're not agreeing to it. But I was referencing their stance, that the union stance is we've already agreed to a pay cut, and I would say that's not entirely true.
Okay.
As for the NFL rules, they went no on both. Mm-hmm. Sky Judge is going to be done in the preseason with the option to option it in for the regular season, but your beloved onside kick remains. No 4th-and-15 attempt to retain possession.
It is my beloved onside kick. Maybe that's something that puts me in the same category in your eyes as those who like the running game. A mouth breather.
No, it's not the same.
A guy who likes bare weather. A guy who eats a lot of sausage on Sundays. Not the same? Okay, because it sounded like it the way you... When you called it my beloved onside kick, I took that as a shot at my meatballish nature, which I own. It's not an insult as far as I'm concerned. I do find it to be an exciting play, and it's not often where it converts successfully. It shouldn't. It shouldn't, as we discussed with Hub Tuesday. That's one of the – fourth and 15 does not really – you give a chance in this era for the offense to on fourth and 15 to keep possession. That doesn't really reward the team that's leading for leading. That's too commonplace. What was the percentage differential? 16% more converted fourth and 15 last year, I think you said yesterday, than those teams that recovered onside kicks. Now, the Bears have not been historically very good at onside kicks. I think it's a very exciting play. It doesn't happen every game. I don't think it's a high risk of injury and really never has been because nobody gets up enough speed to hit anybody in just that short of stretch of runtime. But I enjoy the onside kick. I'm glad it's
here to stay. Yeah, it's not that I don't enjoy the onside kick, and I agree with you. It is an exciting play. I would just say fourth and 15 would also be an exciting play, and the potential for a higher likelihood of more exciting plays after it is something that I was interested in, right? Because I think it was 11% higher in terms of fourth and 15 versus onside kicks last year. But there's also not a huge sample size here because they just changed the onside kick to make it much tougher to recover, also to reduce the risk of injury, that the team that is kicking off the ball can't get the running start on it, which is why the successful conversion rate of the onside kicks plummeted last year. But the argument, I guess, for those of us that were intrigued by at least doing a trial balloon for a year with the fourth and 15 is that would be an exciting, high-tense play also. And then if you do convert the fourth and 15 and you're the trailing team, well, now you get a bunch more exciting plays where you get a chance for them to come back at the end. So is it a disadvantage to the team who built the lead? No question about it, but it's also an advantage to the potential for more games to be close at the end.
Yeah, Bears converted a fourth and 15 in a fourth quarter last year, and it wound up winning them a football game. That and the first-year official who called a bad roughing the passer call against the Denver pass rusher in week two when they went out there and put the training wheels on Mitchell Trubisky after his awful performance against the Packers. That was a fourth and 15 and an Eddie Pinheiro 52-yard field goal out in the Rocky Mountains that won that one. Oh, those were good times when we had sporting events and Bears games to talk about and mouth breathing to do and sausage to eat.
Oh, at the same time, the mouth breathing and the sausage.
Pinheiro with the De Niro kick.
Oh, Jeff.
That'll do it.
My guess is both of those things change in the not-too-distant future. That they figure out something to do to incentivize a team to have a better chance to get the ball back late, and that the sky judge comes in for the regular season. That one especially, it makes too much damn sense. Help out the officials, get the call right, and reduce the number of complications on the field. That use technology to your advantage. That one, to me, makes too much sense.
I would like to mention quickly, tomorrow afternoon at 5 o'clock, we will send you into your weekend by lighting up, and we invite you to join us in our celebration. The co-founder and frontman, lyricist, keyboardist, Dennis DeYoung of Styx is going to join us in the first chunk of our 5 o'clock hour.
That'll be a great time. Dennis DeYoung called into the show to talk about Ed Farmer, and he's going to come on and tell some more stories tomorrow at 5 o'clock.
That'll play.
Yeah, of course it will. Steve Traxel joined us at 3 o'clock today, as did Evan Drellick from The Athletic. Herb Lawrence, we appreciate your help throughout all of these quarantine shows. Thank you, sir. Nick Shepkowski is our executive producer. We appreciate you. Chris Tannehill makes us sound better than we are each and every day. Joe Strowski is coming up next. For Dan McNeil, I'm Danny Parkins. We are McNeil and Parkins. This is The Score.
It wasn't what I expected. It took, obviously, a major turn and got a little bit unbelievable at parts. It's so well done. The message is on point for the time.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto-pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto-pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well-qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.